accession number 19102, Reel 2.
Eric Vouch, Reel 2.
We disembarked, as I said, at Singapore, and they took us to the race course. at the bottom end of the race course, we put our tents up, and we settled in for the night. There was various rumours going around about the Japanese up in Malaya, and when we got up in the following morning at 6 o'clock time, we were awakened and we were told to pack everything we had got and we would be sent up into Malaya. We were paraded and I was told that I had got to remain behind with Mr. Griggs, Private Griggs and Private Souster, to look after all the equipment, kit bags and stuff that was to be moved up later. The rest of the battalion and the platoon that I was in all went off up into Malaya. We then lost communication with them and we just stayed here at the racecourse until the battalion eventually found its way back after the fiasco that they encountered up at Pachapahat, Sangarang, and just up into Malaya. The Japanese overrun them and cut them off. Some came back by road, some came back by the sea, and a lot of men never did return. We heard about one or two various officers that had been killed, and the first officer that was killed was Lieutenant Rutter and Private Curtis. Corporal George Plitch got back and said what had happened, and Mr. Plitch is still alive and he's 82 year old, and he still lives here in Wisbeach. And funnily enough, I spoke to him last night when I called on him, and he's in very good health. When the battalion eventually arrived back and was reformed in Singapore, we all joined up with them in the middle of the Singapore island.
So you personally never went into Malaya?
No, I never went into Malaya, no. There was just the three of us, as I said, that remained behind. We were told that we were to be reserves, signal reserves, in case anything happened to any of the members, which, funnily enough, I think all the Singapore club, listen to me, all the chappies that went up all got back from Malaya. We never lost any personnel from the signal platoon at all.
So what were you doing in the meantime whilst they were in Malaya?
Well, we remained at the golf course and transported all of the equipment, kit bags, to a warehouse in Singapore itself. We had transport there, and we transported all this stuff into the warehouse, and we remained at the golf course, race course, not golf course. Oh, I'm getting confused now, aren't I? The race course, until the battalion returned. We then reformed and was put into the middle of Singapore, and I was detailed to go to A Company with a Private Hammond. were then placed all around the coast at our little section, the A Company, and Private Hammond and myself were the telephone operators and kept in communication with the headquarter company. Well, we hadn't got enough equipment to meet our needs, so I pinched a cycle from the A Company people and cycled back to our headquarters and fetched some more equipment. Coming out of the headquarters, I bumped into our commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Thorne. And I stopped, got off my cycle, and saluted him. And he said, "Where do you think you're going?" I said, "I'm going back to A Company." He said, "Well, you'd better take somebody with you, because there's Japanese around." So he said, "Be extremely careful." So I waited until he's gone, then I got on the cycle and I went off on my own. Afterwards, I thought, what a silly thing to do. But then, in those circumstances, you don't have time to think or think about your own safety. You just do what you're told to do, which is the right thing to do when you're a soldier, I suppose it is. I don't ever consider myself being a very good, smart soldier, but I did my job as I was taught to do. I went back to A Company and I never met any Japanese. I got back safely. And then, of course, after a time, we had to retire back and back and back. And everything was such a fiasco. Nobody knew who was who, where you were going, what you were going to do. And, of course, eventually we had to surrender.
How had you been getting on with the civilians in Singapore?
We never really had much time to meet any of the civilians in Singapore. The people that we met at the race course was the Salvation Army people that stayed on the island. And they had vans of food, cups of tea, buns and things like that. The actual native population, we have very, very little communication with them.
How much was the Salvation Army's efforts appreciated?
Oh, very much so. You'll never hear any FIPO say anything detrimental or anything against the Salvation Army. They think the Salvation Army was a most wonderful setup, and to think that the people of the Salvation Army stayed on the island even after the surrender to try and administer good to the troops. But of course, they, like everybody else, was put into camps.
Was there a chaotic situation in Singapore?
Oh, everybody was chaotic. They hadn't got a clue what was happening. We were being bombed, shot at, you name it, everything was happening, and hardly anybody knew what was really going on. Eventually, of course, Percival surrendered, and we were then, what we all said, was put into the bag.
How did you feel when you heard the news that Singapore had been surrendered to the Japanese?
In one way, it was a sense of relief, I should think. We were relieved to think that we were not going to be shot at or bombed or anything else anymore. We were very apprehensive on how the Japanese would react to us, because we'd heard so many horrendous stories of what the Japanese did to prisoners and to various individuals that we just didn't know what would happen. Eventually, we all managed to march and get down to Changi, where we were all put into the barracks were being used as hospitals, Roberts Barracks, as I remember it, and we were just under a piece of VATAP roofing for the first night we were there. And then the next day we were put into what they called Gun Park Square, into the garages that was on this Gun Park Square. And then we were left to our own devices for quite a few days. Nobody knew what was going to happen. We used to do parades, tenkos as they called it. If you did anything wrong and the Japs saw you, well, you'd get a bashing. It was rather a period of time, the first few days, of wondering all the time what was going to happen.
Did you get any bashings yourself?
During the next 3.5 years, very, very many. I don't know why, but I always seem to be running into trouble somewhere along the line. But after we, really got settled in at Changi and got ourselves into a routine, the Gang of Five, as I called it, we all got together and remained together until we went to... They marched us up to Bukatima. Now, Bukatima, as we called it, was the headquarters of the Royal Air Force in the Far East. And we were in this particular camp for a few months, building roadways on the golf course at Bukatima. And there was also a bridge, a wooden decorative type of bridge of the Japanese styling, built over the McRitchie Reservoir. Over the other side of the reservoir, there was a hill, which was being, a shrine was being built for the Japanese soldier that was killed and whatever they called it. We finished doing various roadworks across the golf course. And after a few weeks or a few months, I think it was June we went up, they then told us that we were going to be moved to Thailand, which they then called a holiday camp, which would be much better conditions.
Just before we go on to that, was it hard work at Bukatima?
Not particularly. The only thing is, if you... we were only just making little roadways across the golf course. It wasn't hard work, but it was very hot work in the sun. And then, of course, when it did rain, that used to cool you down, and you'd be very cold. But, no, it wasn't... I wouldn't say it was hard work. Building the bridge and the shrine they put up was much heavier work because of the heavy wooden logs and wood constructions that they were building. They were heavy to lift. But we never had anything to do with that. We were just on the roads, and we were just using what they called a chunkle. And a chunkle is a tool that's... Well, I suppose it's the... only tool they use in those sort of areas, a chunkle. They don't have spades or forks or hoes. They just have the one tool, the chunkle.
Is it like a mattock?
It's like a big square hoe. And you and just knock it down into the ground and drag these soil to you. And you even lifted the soil onto the baskets that we were using to move the soil, and rocks and stones and what have you, and transporting them away from or to and from the sites.
Who was supervising the work?
Pardon?
Who was supervising the work?
The Japanese engineers were supervising us, and the Korean people were guarding us, and they were more troublesome than the actual Japanese at that time. The Japanese engineers, yes, they were very nasty towards us, but the Koreans were even nastier. And they would knock you around for any little thing. If they saw you doing something you shouldn't be doing or you wasn't working hard enough, they would come along and just belt you with their rifle butts. If they got bamboo, they would hit you with bamboo. And you just had to make sure that if you were skiving or trying to do something that you shouldn't be doing, you'd got to be very careful that they didn't spot you.
What type of things would you be doing which you shouldn't be doing?
A good many things, I should say. Taking a half a basket of soil. If you hadn't got enough soil in it, they would give you a belt across the shoulders, the legs, with a piece of bamboo. If you went to the toilet, you would say a benjo, and they would either let you go or else you had to sort of bob down where you were and do your business. Benjo is a toilet. I believe in this day and age the word benjo in Japan is now obsolete. They now call the toilet the powder room. And all the Japanese now go to a powder room. They don't go to a toilet. It's a powder room.
So
the word benjo is considered to be a rude word.
Was there any means of adding to your diet there at Bukittima?
No. The food that we were receiving at Bukittima gradually got very bad. I can remember when we had our rice, we would lay it out on the table and knock the maggots that were cooked with it out of the rice, and then you would get fed up doing this because there was more lice or more maggots than there seemed to be rice. So you would close your eyes and eat your rice and the maggots as well. When I think of it, it's rather a gruesome sort of effort that you encountered.
Would you get anything in the way of meat or vegetables?
Occasionally we were getting various types of greens, but they were cooked in just plain water, and no, we just had rice and a few bits of greens. Meat, no. No, we never had any meat. The only time that we had any meat, I think, would probably be when we were up country.
Would you get any help from civilians?
Not in our particular camp, no. No.
Was there any way in which you could spoil the work?
Well, on the work that we were doing at the time, you was only just levelling out the various areas to make a roadway so people could either walk or transport could go along these roads. There were no pavements or anything like that. It was just levelling up the ground to make the roads. So there was nothing we could actually do to say that we could mess it up in any particular way.
So you were telling me about the news that you were to go to Thailand.
Well, when we were informed that we were going to be moved up to Thailand, one of my friends by the name of Green and myself, we decided that we would raid the Japanese cookhouse and see what we could pinch to sustain ourselves on this journey that we were going, because we were warned that, you know, it'd be just food at any particular time. You'd be lucky if you got any. So we eventually raided this Japanese cookhouse and we pinched. It would be, I should think, a 14-pound pack of tins of corned beef. You know, they're in about that size. We got back to the area where we were billeted in Bukittinggi, and we dug a hole and buried this corned beef. When we were told that we were on the move, we decided we'd dig this corned beef up and distribute it between our friends so that we could transport it and eat it on the way. When we went back to dig it up, it had gone. Somebody else must have seen us, and they turned around and pinched it off us. So we were very annoyed about that. We had our suspicions on who it was, but we couldn't prove anything, so we let it go at that and said, right, they're in better nick than what we are. But the two people, I'm not going to mention their names, the two chappies that we think pinched it from us died in Chiang Kai later on. So if we were correct in our assumption that they were the people that pinched it from us, it didn't do them any good whatsoever. So since we have been home, we have spoken about this and talked about it on quite numerous occasions, and we feel that the two chappies that pinched it really, well, I don't know what to say, they didn't really help themselves whatsoever. They took this stuff, and now whether they had all of it or whether they distributed it amongst their friends, we don't know. But anyway, we lost our corned beef. On the journey, they took us to the station and put us into these cattle trucks, whether it be 30 to 40 to a boxcar, not cattle trucks, a boxcar. And we were in those 4, 5, 6 days going up through Malaya. We stopped occasionally to be allowed to go to the toilet and to be fed, which when they fed us was very, very minute amount of rice that they gave us. And quite a number of the boys died. They suffered with malaria, dysentery, beriberi, you name it, they had it. I myself stood the journey very well indeed. I had no trouble whatsoever.
Why do you think that was?
I haven't got a clue. Whether it's all in the mind, you know, and whether you decided that, you know, what the Japs, what they could dish out to you, you could take. And this, I think, was probably the best attitude of being a prisoner, of saying, right, the little yellow bastards, they won't beat me, I'll beat them. And this, I think, was what quite a number of us, the attitude that we had. Eventually, we got to a place called Ban Pong. We disembarked off this, out of these trucks, and they marched us down the road, which at that time, the monsoon floods were there, and we marched down the road to these huts in water, about 3 foot of water. We waded through this, and we were put into this camp on these atap, in these atap huts, and on the bamboo slats. And we were there for the one night, and then we were marched down to Kanchanaburi. I forget how many, probably 2 or 3 days we were marching down to Kanchanaburi. I can't remember how many days it took. And then we were put on boats, went across the river, unloaded, and then marched through which we then encountered as the first piece of jungle that we really knew was jungle, to the Chiang Kai camp. When we arrived at the Chiang Kai camp, we met up with other people that had been sent in advance, and we heard so many horrendous stories there that we really didn't know whether to believe them or not. But we soon found out that they would have us on parade and make us tenko, and tenko means numbering off, and everybody had to, in the front line, would have to number off in Japanese, and the Japanese numbers was ichi, ni, san, si, go, roko, sichi, hachi, ku, Jew. That was 1 to 10. And then, of course, they carried on. If anybody got it wrong, and we had to do it 2 or 3 times, we would stand there for probably 1 hour, 2 hours at a time. When they took us out to start working on the actual railway embankments, we had to line up in the mornings as soon as it was daylight. They would issue us with tools, count us 4 or 5 times, and then they would march us to the embankment, and we would have to start work. You would work during the course of the whole of the day, and would have to do so many, I think it was 1 meter per man to be moved onto the embankments and that sort of thing. Of course, some of the chappies just couldn't do it. And there was 2 boys from March by the name of Sharp, tough old boys, and they would turn round and do their stint, then turn round and help the people that couldn't do the work. They would do it for them. Sadly, the 2 boy Sharps, they both died, I believe, of cholera up at a camp called Takanun. They were great lads. There was a